Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference Podcast. Gardner Campbell and Jim Groom like to get together and discuss the current state of higher ed. Gardner is director of the Academy for Teaching and Learning at Baylor University, and Jim Groom is an instructional technology specialist at the University of Mary Washington. A couple of years ago, I caught the two on video debating EduPunk. And this year, I got to talk to them about the current state of higher ed faculty as it relates to students.
Gardner, one of the more general topics you bring up in your blog from your travel to Spain, I believe it was, the hope to create an online learning space that supports and inspires the joy of learning. Now, could you give us some ideas about what this might look like in reality, and more specifically, what's holding institutions back from creating those spaces?
Well, I think for a lot of institutions, when they think about how students feel, they think at a very superficial level. They think, you know, are the students happy? Do they have climbing walls? Do they have enough dances? Are we doing enough to make sure that their rooms are pretty and that they have balcony views? And, you know, those things are important in a way, I guess. But to me, they're a very superficial way of thinking about the joy of learning, which is a phrase that Eva de Lera at the Open University of Catalonia has really brought up into my awareness. It's the research she's working on right now. It's been very important to me. So when I think about the joy of learning, I'm not thinking about these kind of creature comforts. I'm thinking about what it's like to have a mind that's fully engaged, to have interest that's awakened, to have students who, you know, would never want to miss class because that's a time when their colleagues, their fellow students, because they need to be colleagues for each other, are really a kind of self-stimulating network, the way the internet is, where somebody's got something to bring and everybody's riffing off of other people's ideas and people are getting inspired. And that's just a great feeling. It's a peak experience feeling. Csikszentmihalyi talks about flow and peak experience when you lose yourself in your work. You can't keep track of time and you just feel a sense of fullness of being. That, to me, ought to characterize most, if not all, of the educational experience. Doesn't mean we're not going to work hard. Doesn't mean there aren't things we have to just sit down and memorize, sit and sweat, as my German teacher used to put it. But it does mean that the hard work we do is characterized by joy. And I think a lot of times in school, we think, well, joy is optional. When you engage the joy of learning, that's messy. It's hard to scale it. It's hard to know how to structure a curriculum around it. It takes real energy, and it takes a certain vulnerability on the part of the teacher as well. The teacher has got to be interested in the joy of learning, or there's not going to be joy for the students. So I think, especially in an industrial model of education, people have tended to discount the role of emotion, of interest, of joy, and I think that's been a real mistake. I think it's time to re-look at all of that.
Let me throw one more thing out there, and maybe, Jim, you can respond to this. What you're saying sounds similar to me as saying, well, the band just needs to get this right vibe. You know what I mean? It sounds a little vague to me. What are the hard, true facts of doing this on a large scale? That is, we can implement this, and this will be the outcome.
Yeah. Pardon is very vague. I agree with you. I'm kidding. Let's go.
It sounds very much like you're saying we need to like have this riffing idea and really get into talking about learning. But like, what is the hard, fast policies you can put across a whole industry that's going to make this happen?
I love Gardner's idea of the teacher actually being a part of the process, right? Okay. I mean, I think that's what I came out with your own education, with this idea of a vision and the idea of there being a sense of a band and a rhythm and a movement within the classroom, I think is what probably makes Gardner classes seem different. Like there is a sense of purpose.
Sure.
There's a sense of beyond the idea of, right, drill and kill, we got to do this stuff. Yeah, certainly things you have to read and memorize, but certain things have to feel like this class is just an example of the possibility. You know what I mean? It's just an example of, and the fact is when you bring the internet of it, it's not just a dry run. It's actually happening, and it's happening in real time. And if your professor is in there with you doing it, I think it just changes the stakes for everyone involved. Mm-hmm. Not giving assignments as, here's your dribble work that you do, and then I'll evaluate, but here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to try and see. It brings back to the idea of vision. And when the faculty, the students, realize that everyone can take the same prompt, the same assignment, and have a totally different vision around that, but still come around in some sort of concert of thought and concert of conversation, it does change the focus, and it does change the momentum of a class. People are actually excited about the assignment. First thing they check when they get up in the morning is, what is that daily shoot, and how are they going to see the world?
And it's sort of a philosophy of teaching, almost.
Oh, yeah, it's a philosophy of teaching. And you asked a question that I get a lot. It's right after the, how would you grade that question? You know, what policies, what outcomes, what kind of institutional orientation? To me, first of all, those are the wrong questions to start with. Doesn't mean they're not important. They're the wrong ones to start with. When I hear those questions, what I hear is, so Gardner, we're really excited by your enthusiasm, but how can we just kind of tack that onto what we're already doing? And the answer is, well, you can't, and you don't really want to, I don't think. There's something that I think all of us have felt at these magic educational moments that we feel so deeply. We understand this is where something has happened, and we want to be able to find that again. Now, you also ask about vague language. You're a musician. Vibe, feel, these are not vague terms to a musician. They may not be able to be articulated in specific words, but musicians are very keenly aware when the band is tight, when the band is not. Musicians know when the drummer is in the pocket, slightly behind the beat. Now, there are ways to teach that. There are ways to think about it. But it really is a matter of vibe and feel. And I would submit that those seem like vague words, but they actually name very specific states of being that artists understand. And for me, part of the joy of learning is that there is an art of cognition we're working on here. And to me, that's not optional. If you have that, many different policies can work. If you don't have that, I don't care what your syllabus looks like, you're going to have a dead class. You know, what do students say? The teacher made the subject come alive. Well, what do they mean by that? I think they mean it was interesting, that somehow it seemed vital and important to them, not because they're being pandered to, but because the teacher is able to say, look at your life. This particular thing is a specific instance of a much, much bigger idea. Let's explore that. Instead of saying, you come here with nothing, I come to this relationship with everything, sit down while I give you my everything. That's not a relationship. That's actually, to me, a misunderstanding of that joy of learning.
As the internet and online tools develop, we've seen a progression. You know, in the early days of the internet, there's the democratization of writing because you can put your stuff out there. Then we're seeing the democratization of music because anyone with a PC can make a CD now and or MP3 and put it out there. And now we're seeing that with video, with YouTube and the low-priced camcorders, flips, and things that are out there. So many forward-thinking institutions are also starting to put many courses online for free, leading to a sort of democratization of education. I can go to Harvard and get some classes for free. Many of these movements decimated the traditional model of business. So what do you see happening in the future with education? If you can access all this education online for free, are we really just buying pieces of paper in the end? Or what is that going to look like? How is the industry going to be affected by this sort of democratization? That's my word. I don't know if that's the correct word, but of all this information and all this knowledge.
I have a particular sense of the change in question of the university and the idea right now that, you know, higher ed will follow suit with journalism and what we see the music industry and the video industry and movie industry. And I think to some degree that's potentially true. You start to see new models emerging. And I don't know if these models are necessarily going to replace the old one. We have OER, we have peer-to-peer university, we have the University of Everything, we have Open University that's trying to frame out new things. And I think all that's true, but I don't think that content delivered through the web is a replacement for a relationship and for education as we've known it. I think you can do that and you can make it cheap and you can think of computers as a mechanism to deliver and as a transaction of delivery. But I really think at the heart of that is a neoliberal interpretation of a kind of decimation of the workforce that is academia right now. And what I think is crazy is that academics don't even realize it. And they aren't even engaging the argument that needs to happen. I mean, I heard a stat recently, and we could probably fact check this, and I probably should, but 35% of faculty in the U.S. are tenured. That means 65% are part-time, underpaid workers. And yes, we're going to have a decimated higher ed system just based on that alone. But then when you start thinking of technology as something you graft on top of that in order to replace the existing 35% of tenured faculty, all you have is workforce training. All you have is a very kind of, I think, dumbed down relationship where the question of vision and on education that Gardner brought up with Milton becomes, you know, irrelevant. You know, we're just training people for work and accreditation. And I think that's the scariest thing about technology. I think there is a really, for me, a great liberating sense of it, but just as equally a great kind of consolidating logic of technology that's going to replace some of, I think, the most intimate spaces. Now, this brings to the question of how do we as educational technologists and professors think through the intimacy of this technology without gutting it of its very value, which I still think is people. And I'll throw this over to you to just riff on that. But that's really where I'm seeing it does need to happen, but we need to be thoughtful about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a really cruel irony here. In many ways, the industrial model of education has paved the way for its own demise because knowledge has been thought of as a thing that's transferred from knower to knower. We understand now, no, that's not right. Cognition is a much more delicate, complex, and interesting thing than just, I have it, I shovel it, you take it into your hopper, and we're done. You know, higher education has thought, well, we can actually sustain this enterprise. If the class has 500 people in it, why not 1,000? Why not 1,500? Why not 2,000 and we'll stream it live on TV outside of the lecture hall? But that's not what education is. You can't get education delivered to you. Education is an experience. What we do know is that the internet is fantastic at allowing for shared experience. We know that as a platform for communication and a place where really intimate bonds can be formed, the internet is a fantastic medium, much better than television, much better than radio, which I say with some sorrow because I love radio, much better than anything we've had, except maybe a handwritten letter. And it scales, and it can be really, really interesting the way these things are put together, but not if we think of this as a mode of delivering content. It has to be a platform for the joy of learning, where relationships can be formed, can be fostered, can be encouraged. And frankly, I think if the current tenured professoriate really got their heads around the way the internet works, we'd be able to get back to our roots in a really interesting way. We would find a way in which those intimate experiences that characterize the best of learning can be propagated not just by the professor, but by the students themselves in rich kinds of contact with each other. I love the phrase that Jim just said, students at one with the assignment. Yes, that's what it is. Not in the sense of pandering, not in the sense of, well, boys and girls, what kind of candy would you like me to feed you today? Because people understand that that's not satisfying. The satisfying thing is to say, how can we help you be one with the work? How can we make this something that really does lead to that fullness of being? The internet can make that possible at scale because of its peculiar, distributed, many-to-many properties. Clay Shirky has explained this, I think, very patiently for many years, and people can't quite get it yet. They're like, oh, you mean lolcats? Oh, you mean, you know, and Shirky points out the threshold here is not between bad creativity and good creativity. The real threshold is between not doing anything at all and at least doing something. And if higher education could start to understand, take that something and help the student build it, help students build it together. Don't make it all have to be filtered through the professor. Create a community where students are excited to be in each other's company. I tell my students this. The thing that you should remember most fondly about the class you're taking right now is each other, not me, maybe not even the subject matter. I hope that sticks with them. I hope they've learned that. But the thing you should take with you is the memory of what it was like to be in the presence of these other colleagues. Face-to-face is a wonderful way to do it, but it doesn't define it. We know how to do this on the internet. We've just got to get our heads around it. And if we can't, we are going to see a different kind of computer-aided instruction emerge. Radical disaggregation, fee for hire, yeah. And really a decline in a kind of professionalism that matters, not in the sense of living a cushy lifestyle, but in the sense of true authority, true expertise that fosters a genuine community of learning. It's not too late. A year or two from now, it might be.
That's why I think the erroneous conflation of content with education has replaced, and you bring it to real focus for me, is it should be creativity that should be conflated with education, and it's not. In fact, more and more as we push towards this disaggregated model of the technologically controlled delivery mechanism, I think we're further and further moving from any relationship between education and creativity. Mm-hmm. And the fact is creativity has to happen within an audience. And we've seen through social media over the last 10 years that the audience is built in, that you have people who are, you know, intrinsically seemingly interested in all sorts of things. Why can't we start tapping that with our students? Why can't we start showing them that, hey, this is how the internet works? Hey, this is what it means to run your own space on the internet. Here's what it means to have a digital identity. And I don't care what discipline it relates to, because it cuts across every one of them. And I really think that, you know, it's ridiculous to ghettoize the idea of social media and the internet and higher education. In fact, higher education should be on the forefront of it. They should be promoting the hell out of what they're doing on the internet. And they're hiding from it. They got their head in their sand.
It's a remarkable thing. I seriously do not understand it, except in my more cynical moments. The ARPANET, the progenitor of the internet, was modeled after the distributed, collaborative nature of higher education. And now higher education can't understand the thing that was modeled on its own best practices. That, to me, is nearly incomprehensible. Just as you're saying, this idea of finding the audience, not ghettoizing social media. There's too much talk out there about, well, maybe I need to put my class on Facebook because that's where the kids are. To me, that's as harmful as saying, oh, I'll take some glass beads with me to Manhattan. I hear the digital natives are into glass beads. Har, har, har. The real key here, and I've said this elsewhere, and I'd love to know what Jim thinks about this. It seems to me higher education, the professoriate, the people who are tenured, who are professional, who have the expertise and the experience in teaching and learning to make this happen, they need to be in there as digital citizens themselves, modeling this and not saying what I often hear. Well, I think blogging is good for the students. I don't have time for that. You know, oh, I understand that Twitter is a big deal. How can I use that in my class? And then you say, well, are you on Twitter? Do you understand how that works? Oh, no, I don't have time for that. My worst case scenario, I talked to a professor who was going to do a presentation to an audience of business persons about social media and Twitter. And this professor didn't even have a Twitter account. Now, these social media, they're messy. You have to filter things. You have to learn a new way of being, just like you have to learn a new way of driving to drive on the interstate. If you choose not to do that, fine. But then don't come complaining when things have gone very far down the road and your chance to be heard and to be a vital participant in the discussion is gone. You made that choice. You decided you didn't want to learn how to type. That was for secretaries. You don't want to learn how to do social media. That's for kids. That, to me, is the worst kind of injury you can do to the learning community. And students pick this up. It's like, oh, this is for you. But really serious people like me, we don't have time for that, which means we don't think it's really important. But we want to make it because we understand you guys like to hang out there. It makes me really sad.
Yeah, it's condescending.
In a way, it really is. And I know people don't mean to be, but flip it into a medium that we all take for granted now. What if professors came in and said, you know, I want you all to read the Scarlet Letter. I'm really tired of it. I'm not going to read it anymore in my life. I actually don't even think it's a very good book. But I think you should probably have read it. So go read it. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to have a discussion? I don't think so.
Right.
You know, the message has come through loud and clear. Eat your spinach. I'm an old person. I don't eat spinach anymore. Yeah, great.
Sure. No, I do. I think the idea of social media still as, you know, something you do, you know, maybe post facto as, you know, something you throw in to get your students interested in something. I mean, it's almost like an afterthought. And it's an afterthought in your class. It's not going to work. And you're going to go and kind of reinforce your own kind of predetermined logic that it doesn't work or that it's not useful. And we see that a lot. And coming from the other side, and I'll frankly say this, it's changed for me not only the way I do business in my work and my job, but how I learn and how I'm going to teach my kids. I mean, it has been for me soulful in every possible way. And it hasn't replaced my real life, and there are some real problems still with the internet that I see, and I see them with Apple, and I see with the takeover of the web, but that's a whole other conversation we won't get into right now, though I do see that as an issue. But I really think that the internet has provided new modes for us to thinking. And I'm not going to let my kids follow down the line of teachers telling them that the web sucks or the web is dangerous or for 12 years not letting them get on the internet. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Screw that. My kids are not going to school. Unschooled all the way. I mean, enough with this. And that's from the internet. That inspiration comes not only from my wife, who's pushed it hardcore, but from this idea that, you know, I don't believe that institutions can keep up with this change right now. And now this is a larger question. I think people like Gardner are our greatest hope for these institutions. But I still think, you know, we're just talking about higher ed. We're not even talking about K-12. It is a deep hole. And every year, it's not like it's just one more year. It's like 10 more years. It's like 20 more years every year with the rate of change going on with the internet.
Yeah, in many ways, I see a retrenchment. And that, I don't know what to say about that. You know, if you're going to be in a band, you want to be in a band in 1963, 64, 65. Possibilities are wide open. It hasn't been set in stone yet. It doesn't belong to the promoters yet. No one really knows what works. Great. And there are some people who are like, and this kind of gets back to your earlier question, which I know was, you know, to frame the discussion. Right. But it's like, well, we don't want to do anything until we know what will really work. Oh, really? Yeah. Tell me what kind of authentic intellectual endeavor of any kind says, oh, I need to know this will have an outcome before I do it. What is that about? That's anti-curiosity. It's anti-research. It's anti-thinking. And this is the thing. It just makes me crazy. I mean, K through 12 has got all these issues. Higher ed, we've got freedom. We've got some resources. We've got people with amazing amounts of training, scope of vision, and the rest. Just as Jim said, we should be exploring this. We should be whooping it up with joy in every area of the internet as a platform for the experience of the joy of learning. And instead, people are like, oh, I'm really worried. What if my kids are Facebooking through class? Well, what if they are? You know, if they weren't doing that, they'd be sleeping or reading the newspaper. Have you thought of a way to use the laptops during class? Well, what would you do? Well, in my case, I use Twitter as a back channel. And now we're back to where we were. Oh, Twitter, I hear that's interesting, but I would never do that. Who has time for all of that? Sure, we're busy people. We have to establish priorities. Why isn't this at or near the top of the list of priorities? Clay Shirky says we are living in the middle of the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race. And I once said this to a group of professors, and the question I got back was, well, what if 95% of that is crap? And I said, well, everything human is like that. You want to talk about print technology? And I pulled out an Airline magazine. So this is a real good example of how print's going to save you? No. What you do is you go for the great stuff, and you help. And this gets right back to Jim's point about creativity. I want my students to be writing to the web. I told my students in my class, you want a better network? Be the network you want the network to be. There's no greater symbol we've ever had for civilization. Why is this hard? I just don't get it.
And when you frame the internet around content, and this is the bigger question, riffing on what you're saying with creativity, when you frame the internet around content, which it has in many regards, with regards to open education, with regards to the idea of, you know, sharing lectures online and stuff, what becomes immediately apparent is that we've understood ourselves as content to be delivered. We haven't understood ourselves as players within a relationship and conversation. And that, to me, is like the professoriate, right? This professional class objectifying themselves and ultimately writing themselves out of history. It's so weird. It blows my mind that this is happening, and everyone in professoriate, which should be like radicalized and be like, screw that. I mean, look what's happening. Like, universities in England are closing down. They're closing philosophy departments. They're doing all sorts. Even in the U.S., UC, 45% tuition increase. How come we are not radicalized around these ideas? Because I really think everybody's come to the foregone conclusion that we are content. Like, we are really just the thing that we kind of deliver. And that's a depressing state of humanity, almost. You know, I mean, it's
I really
weird...
think that people believe that they could take Gardner's class and make a simple website out of it. That people actually believe that.
Like, your syllabus and a couple of PowerPoints that you created are you.
Yeah.
So do you think people really do
believe
that?
I think people believe that that's the commodification of education is being championed as a good thing.
So that's like saying if I learn every Beatles song note for note, I'm going to write the next Beatles hit.
Right. Well, and I think there's also I think it's not always malevolent either. I think it's it's we have working people that are poor and can't go and have the idyllic college experience, which is a lot of what you're talking about. We have people that are working mothers that have to get online at night and get some, and it goes back to worker training, of course. But so what do you do with that sort of thing?
Well, here's these are the ones, and I'll open up right to you in a second. Those mothers working at night, those possibly the ones who can't afford the four-year experience on a beautiful campus and the $40,000, $50,000 a year tuition, which is insane. Well, where do they go? A lot of them go to the nonprofits because community colleges are impacted. They can't take any more students. They have no public funding. I mean, you're right. It is the commodification of education. How many of those nonprofits have tenured professors? How many of them have any kind of accreditation in what they're training their students in? So we've seen, because of, I think, the complete apathy of the professors of at what or the students at large in the U.S. I'll use as an example, we see the emergence of these for-profit. That's the future of education, right? Let's face it. You want to know the future of education? It's ugly.
So you want to know, how do you scale the idyllic experience? And I've said in the past that I think the greatest outcome for these technologies would be to find a way to scale Socrates. Well, we don't have to look very far for that. The internet itself is all about scaling intense experiences. So how does that happen? It happens in a number of ways. One is a kind of spoken hub arrangement. So, for example, one of the ways I'm using the internet with faculty development this semester is by having a networked faculty development seminar. But it's broader than that. It's networked faculty staff development seminar. But it's broader than that. It's networked faculty staff grad student local K through 12 seminar. And there's a local site at Baylor, there's a local site at Rice, there's a local site at the Monterey Institute for International Studies, local site at Penn State, local site at Houston Community College, local site at McLennan Community College. There are some other players in the mix as well. You have an intense local experience with a common syllabus facilitated by aggregation of blog posts, delicious resource collection, and so forth, happening across all of the sites. The idea is here, you have a strong local experience of people meeting together face-to-face once a week for 90 minutes to engage with a really interesting set of readings. I set the syllabus, but I'm in conversation with everybody else, what's working, what's not working, thinking about this. And then it's set up so that that strong local experience is then amplified by the network because we're all reading each other's blog posts. We're all reading. Now, that scales. No one is but so there are differences. No one is assigned to read each blog post. Nobody's earning credit for this. Could you adapt this to a credit model? I don't know. Maybe. Could we rethink the credit model? I think we better. It's a fairly recent invention. Why can't we? So what's happening as a result is that people, I hope, are being brought into a fuller awareness of the possibilities of the network itself. Now, with more faculty, staff, and grad students in really a huge talent pool, we have no lack of smart and talented people in higher education. The key is how to mobilize them through the network so that this experience can have that intense local flavor and be scaled across institutions. This is hard to do because of institutional branding and who's going to get credit and who's going to be productive and blah, blah. But if we can find a way to actually make that sustainable and build in from the beginning the idea that this is a network, I think we can find a way to make that idyllic experience available to the harried office worker who's trying to get an MFA at night, to the 18-year-old who has decided, I really need to start working now. But I also don't want to give up on my education. I want to try to keep both of those things going. And we need to be creative. It needs to be eclectic. Maybe there's a four-week summer institute where we're all face-to-face. Then it's distributed. We need to be creative about the possibilities for learning communities instead of saying, well, gee, I don't know. Should we vote on a May term? It's like, stop. That's just, you can't make it part of what already was. And you just had better stop trying.
Well, I think what we also need to do is get a sense of how in the public sector we're going to start funding some of this. Because the problem is we start giving all the funding or kind of relegating all the funding to the private sector. And look what's happening. They're gutting the process. We still need public investment in this. We still need public institutions to step up and fund professors and create full tenure positions and actually keep some of that alive. Because otherwise it's going to go. And I love that idyllic vision, but without funding, without some sense of, you know, money for people who do it, you know, for student aid for students who take those classes, we're not going to get anywhere. And that's the kind of thing. Technology is not going to solve that. The internet's not going to fully solve that. Probably government funding to some degree, or some sort of public funding is going to solve it. And that's a problem with education right now, being gutted.
Gardner Campbell and Jim Groom at the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference.